And what is shaking, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and I gotta tell you, something has got to give out here in the wine industry, and we're gonna get into just what that is after some, you know, continued just amazing conversations, both from being on the road earlier this spring, but also folks that have been out to the winery in recent days, talking about kind of where Napa has gone, not just from like a price and a flavor standpoint, but just kind of people's genuine expectations of maybe fine wine and how tastes are kind of evolving right now in and around the world of wine. We're going to get into all that today. You might hear it, I'm a little raspy in the voice. This is the day after the first day of our Bottle Rock Festival, and I think I sang every Green Day song yesterday as I got onto the stage. It's been a very nice, relaxing week. I tried to take a little bit of time off this week. We've been focused on a lot of home projects, trying to take a little bit of R&R. It's been a busy few weeks after getting off the road, and I'm trying to settle down just a little bit. Hence why this episode is a little late once again, because normally do release these on Wednesday. Of course, if you're listening to this as it's released, it is Saturday as we're kicking off Memorial Day weekend here. Before we get too far into it, of course, a couple of very quick announcements. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks. That's at MTGA Wines on the Book of Face, YouTube, Instagram, the social network formerly known as Twitter. You can like and subscribe the episodes wherever you're consuming them. Please leave a little rating or review if you can. That really helps with just the algorithm and kind of letting us know that you're enjoying it, or if there's any critiques or anything that we could do to potentially, you know, improve the show. Be sure to check out our website, mtgawines.com or blairpaytonwines.com, to find out a little bit more about us, who we are, what we do in the wine side of things. Please be 21 years of age or older if you start shopping around for wine on those sites. But you can also sign up for things like our mailing lists if you so choose to. Also on the homepage of MTGA Wines, you can find a little email box kind of down if you scroll down that homepage where you can submit questions for our monthly Q&A episodes that come out the last Wednesday of every month, which is right around the corner. So you've got a couple of days to submit your questions for May 28th when we're going to be releasing that Q&A episode, so be sure to jump on it. All right, let's get into this, shall we? Now, before we get too far into kind of the conversations we've been having, we've touched on some of this stuff previously, but I wanted to dive into this in a little bit more detail just based on, you know, it's kind of anecdotal information, which I know can be tough to really, you know, wrap your head around, because, you know, we kind of like to try and find, you know, concrete, like, evidence of things. You want to try and have some sort of measurement. But I think we're seeing that kind of in real time for a number of reasons in terms of the wine industry, kind of this rocky period that we're in, and kind of the rocky period that Napa and California wines are in, just in general. And we're going to try and touch base on a lot of that today. Over the last week, one of the reasons why this episode is coming out on today, Saturday, as we're recording this, is because I was trying to really kind of wrap my head around the direction I wanted to take this conversation. I knew what kind of the overarching theme was, and that is, you know, between my time in the Midwest and also some of the tastings that we've hosted at the winery very, very recently, a lot of consumers, some folks such as yourselves who we saw out on the road, some folks that we've seen out at the winery more recently, some of the accounts, whether they've been retail shops or restaurants, country clubs, things of that nature that we've been in touch with and talking to, everyone's opinion of Napa is not the best right now, at least from my perspective. There are still people, obviously, that love it, but they're looking at it through like what it was 10, 15 years ago. And it has nothing really to do with the price. I mean, obviously, things are more expensive out here than they ever have been. It's an expensive industry to be in the first place. The demand for Napa wines has always been high. And you saw, you know, supply and demand kick in. There's only so much Napa Cabernet out there. There's only so much of it that you can make at a really affordable price. You know, if you find a great bottle of Napa Cab right now for $60, that is a steal and a half, right? It's more likely going to be 80 to like 120, somewhere in that range, very typically, which can be kind of a bummer, right? But them is the ropes. And, you know, I think folks are in a position now, we've talked a little bit about this as well, where it's like, you know what, instead of buying the cheaper stuff that is lower quality, very sweet, and just not well-made realistic, and that is a subjective opinion of mine, we'd rather trade up. We'll gladly buy three bottles of, you know, the $120 bottle of wine versus six of the $60 bottle of wine, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I think there's something to be said for that, that you do see folks kind of trading up, and maybe they're consuming less, but they are consuming higher quality wines. And I think that that is something that bodes well for the wine industry in general, is that the consumer, you guys out there, are becoming more discerning. You're more open about talking and experience, talking about wine, experiencing it. There's a better understanding of kind of what is high quality versus low quality, especially when it comes to things like the additives that can be used or the sugar content in wines that's not labeled in brands like Meiomi or whatever that case is, because that's kind of been the shining star example that's been in the news over the last, you know, few months, right? And I think people are starting to really like catch on to that kind of stuff. And as a result, we're having more of these open-ended kind of conversations of trying to figure out like what way is up, and also trying to give you, the consumer, a little bit more kind of, I guess, confidence in what you're consuming. Now, the thing that continues to be echoed, you know, quite literally in the cave during some of these conversations is that Napa's gotten, for the quality that they're getting, the price doesn't match up. That, yes, it's good wine, but for 120 bucks, even 80 bucks or 60 bucks, is it really worth it? Can I find an equivalent quality and find more value in other regions or other producers? You know, we talked a little bit about this, you know, with consultants and things of that nature, where you have one consultant working for many, many brands, and one of those brands charges 100 bucks for the Cabernet, another charges 600. And you're like, well, is that wine, that 600 bucks, you know, really six times better than the $100 bottle? Or not, right? And of course, you know, it's always subjective for folks. But I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, the wine industry is having to grapple with. On top of that, more and more we're hearing like Napa just got too rich. It got too jammy. The alcohol's too high. There's too much new oak. There's no subtlety in these wines. And for the overwhelming majority of them now, that's kind of the vibe. Now, as you get into some of the nooks and crannies and the hillsides for us small producers, obviously that changes quite a bit. And even some big producers still do a halfway decent job of making high quality Napa Cabernet that has some finesse. But that has gotten, you know, more few and far between. And what is generally kind of like available out in the world, whether that's in restaurants or retail shops, tends to be kind of that, you know, trendy, maybe a little sweet, really rich, really jammy, you know, style of Napa Cabernet, which is just not necessarily, you know, the best thing, right? Hold on a second. I'm like, of course our neighbor starts leaf blowing as I'm trying to keep the window open, keep it cool in here. So hopefully that didn't mess with the sound too much, but we got the window closed, so we're all good. Where was I? So, you know, that's kind of the overarching vibe, right? Is that Napa's just kind of gotten a little too big for its britches, quite literally, stylistically. And the conversations I've had now, as I've like brought this up, and this is, you know, kind of the great thing about even a weekend like this, where, yeah, it's a bottle rock, it's a music festival, we were talking to and running into a bunch of our colleagues who are all there to, yeah, enjoy the shows and listen to some music. But everyone's like, how are things going right now? Like, are you doing all right? Because we know that this is kind of a rocky time in the industry. We all start talking about it. And there's a little bit of shop that's talked, even as we're trying to enjoy a great music show, right? And that's certainly what happened yesterday. And more people are kind of like, yeah, this seems to be kind of this trend, is that folks are just not as big on the Napa side of things as they are. It's expensive. The quality doesn't necessarily live up to the expense of some of these wines. And, you know, when you see brands coming out with those wines that are $125, $175, $300 or whatever, it's like, okay, well, yeah, it must be good. It seems as though it tastes yummy, but is it really objectively better than anything else that's being made out there right now? And that more kind of pertains to newer producers that are kind of the new kids on the block, the new companies who have come in over the last maybe 10 years and said, hey, let's jump on this Napa wine thing. It's really blowing up again, and we can charge an arm and a leg and provide this great experience and make a ton of money. And that just, you know, obviously hasn't panned out for some people, as you've seen with some of the bakerumsies and tasting rooms closing and the articles that have been coming out over the last, you know, year of how this industry is kind of going through these trials and tribulations right now, right? So, you know, there is kind of this state of flux. And, you know, this was actually, we were talking to a friend of ours that's, you know, kind of more on the vineyard management side of things, and talked to a few actually. And what's really interesting, especially when it comes to like the kind of high octane nature of Napa right now and the style, like high alcohols, more jammy kind of rich styles, is, and I never thought about it this way, but it was an interesting point. There's a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's worth saying. Something on the viticultural side that I'm sure some of you probably are aware of. I mean, it is agriculture, right? But there's a certain amount of like pests and disease and things that you have to worry about, right? Because if some of these get into your vineyard, it can severely limit the ability of the vines to produce what we would consider in this day and age very high quality fruit. Typically what it does is kind of stunts the growth of the vines and the process of growing the fruit. The fruit doesn't get nearly as ripe. The characteristics aren't nearly as lush and plush as you might want. And you can make kind of typically these more like edgy, what would be considered like underripe wines today. Now, if you go back 20, 30 years, there's a lot more of kind of these issues, less with pests specifically, maybe outside of like some nematodes and things in like, or phylloxera even like before that, maybe some mites or things like, but for the most part, we're talking about things like red blotch and leaf roll and like diseases that kind of affect the vines. And because a lot of that, it's not been like eradicated, but because there was a lot more of that out in the vineyards, you had big swaths of Napa that were frankly producing way more restrained wines than they are today because the fruit just could not get as ripe as you might expect. And now that vineyard managers and farming companies have kind of gone on this, you know, war path of like, we need to have like a clean vineyard with little to no disease. And the second we see it, we got to rip that vine out and spot replant. You know, you have, I think, what would be considered healthier vineyards than ever before. The issue, as I see it, is now these vines are getting this fruit super, super ripe. Lots of sugar in it, which converts to lots of alcohol in the wines. Now, when you get that wine into the cellar, one, you got to contend with that fermentation actually finishing if it's a higher than normal alcohol, because that alcohol content will all kill off your fermentation at a certain point if it does get too high. That is a thing. Number two, you are also dealing with, okay, now you have these crazy, intense, jammy, juicy wines that don't necessarily have the structure that you might want. So now it's like, okay, we can either add acid or more tannin like artificially to these wines, or we can, you know, use maybe more new barrels and say, hey, let's give it more barrel tannin, this phenolic structure that the wine needs to have like this backbone. So it's kind of this, it seems to be now, and this is the first time I've really thought about it this way, and from like that farming standpoint, you have these super healthy vineyards that are producing the super ripe fruit, and now winemakers are doing our best to like contend with that characteristic, because sometimes that phenolic development is, and those flavors and aromas and everything that's coming out of the vineyard just don't quite get there till as late in the season. You know, there's not this glass ceiling that these vines are hitting because the vineyards are really, really healthy. So they're just going and going and going, and you're making these super extracted, super alcoholic, opulent wines. And for a while there is a market for that because you're like this juicy, jammy, lots of new oak, and you know, it was kind of gave it this air of like quality. If you had this really sexy, smooth, you know, thing with this like big toasty oak characteristic, you're like, oh, they spent a lot of time and money. It was a great long hang time. They obviously spent a lot of money on the barrels, and that kind of inferred this quality. And, you know, I've been, you know, the biggest critique of this style, or one of them, since I got back into the industry, of like, this isn't it. Like, this is so, these wines are very one, maybe two dimensional, and there's not a lot to write home about when it comes to them. Like, the quality and kind of the bang for your buck when it comes to Napa Cabernet, I think, and we've mentioned this many times on the show, it's homogenized at an outrageous rate. There are a lot of issues in the cellar that winemakers are having to deal with in terms of like adding acid back or adding more tannin or, you know, whatever it is to kind of like contend with this now chemistry project that winemaking has become. Where if you go back to an era of, say, like the mid to early 90s, where you had wines with a little bit more finesse, they weren't getting as ripe, and you winemakers had to still be creative within what was coming out of those vineyards, but you still had more finesse. One of the groups that, you know, that we were talking about this in the cellar last week or the week before, you know, we remember, you know, the days when you had some of the big names in the room that just weren't nearly as extracted, nearly as sweet, nearly as manufactured, you know, and they were some of the best wines that California and the United States had to offer. And now today, they're a shadow of themselves because of how much sugar is added to them, because of all the manufacturing processes that go into them. And there is kind of this, you know, opinion that is circulating around, I think, all of us as wine consumers, not just within the industry, that we want wines where less is more. That the less you have to do to it and the less you're trying to push this square peg through this round hole, the better. And this was really kind of, it was interesting because yesterday, the HBIC, Brittany, we were going over to her sister's house, my sister-in-law's house, to have a little like pre-concert like brunch. And Brittany had purchased a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc from Grocery Outlet Bargain Market. I don't know if many of you are familiar with that particular like grocery chain, but it's kind of like a dings and dents like grocery where it's like, hey, whenever something can't get to a certain market, or we need to like blow it out and like flash sale it out, like this is kind of this outlet that we can have. It's almost like a JCPenney, but for groceries, right? And they started making, I guess, their own like house label, and has a great name on it. It's called Second Cheapest Wine, because everyone knows you never order the cheapest wine off the wine list. You order the second cheapest wine off the wine list. That way you don't look cheap. And two, hopefully you're going to find a little bit more quality and better value for what you're getting. Trick of the trade, right? And it's a $5 bottle, and we have their Sauvignon Blanc. And if you looked me in dead in the eye and said, hey, I found this really great $5 bottle of wine that was, you know, I think made in Napa, but the grapes are from Sonoma. I think that's how it kind of shook out. I'd be like, yeah, right. It's got to be some kind of like sugary, just flabby mess, you know, just this Frankenstein of a wine. And maybe it is. But it certainly didn't taste like it. I'm like, that's probably the best $5 bottle of wine that's been made in the U.S. that I've tried in recent history. It was really good. Shout out to them for figuring out how to make halfway decent wine on a dime and hopefully, you know, make some money off of it. Because, man, for $5 a bottle, your margins are going to be really, 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 really thin. But if you sell, you know, a few million bottles of it, you might be doing all right. But all of us that were there, the few of us that had tried it anyway, got on the conversation of like, this is what like Europe has that we don't in the U.S. in terms of like our wine drinking culture. That, hey, it's okay to love your first growth and your Grand Cru's and whatever. It's all right to love your Napa cult cabs in the same respect, right? But you also need those more everyday kind of wines that you can crush before going to a concert, hanging out by the pool, grilling in the backyard, whatever the case is. Now, are those wines going to be something that you write home about necessarily? Maybe not. But they're perfectly serviceable in terms of just, hey, this is a wine that we can enjoy. So, you know, kind of pulling all of this stuff together, you know, of these conversations that we're having between how, let's say, opulent Napa has become, but also kind of how flabby a lot of these wines have become, how sweet a lot of these wines have become, to the lack of viable options from a kind of lower price point side of things. The wine industry has a lot of figuring out to do. Is that the right turn of phrase? Or maybe it's just like a lot of growing up to do. Maybe I'll put it that way. In that we need to really sort out kind of that next 5 to 10 years of getting people into wine in a more passionate way, I would say. And make it more approachable, easy to understand, and find great value and higher quality in every price point. Not just $5 and not just $500, but everything in between, right? And I think more and more within the industry, we're starting to see that push. When new brands are opening up, or you know, brands are being acquired and restructured by some new company or whatever the case is, diving in and saying, hey, we're going to focus on luxury and increase quality of the wines, which means we're going to take this $90 bottle and start charging, you know, $180 for it. You know, that doesn't necessarily work, right? There's a winery on the Silverado Trail that's changed hands so many times I can't even keep up with it. But I know that one of the folks that bought it after like the first or second iteration, like, hey, we have all this back inventory, including like older white wines and stuff. And their opinion, because they don't know anything about the industry, was, hey, we've bought this. The retail value is this. These wines are all kind of gotten older, you know, across the board between these whites and reds. Let's just increase the price by a third, half, or 100%. And the wine will sell because all wines just get better with age. That was literally their plan. It was like, we bought this winery. There's a ton of inventory. That's great. We can charge an arm and a leg for it because wines get better with age. And it turns out that a lot of those wines didn't. And the quality just wasn't there, especially with some of the white wines that were made there and even some of the reds. And there was just, they were dead in the water before they could even get started because they're, I don't know, they're, like, first principles of, like, let's just sell, like, if we have wine, people will buy it, just doesn't pan out from a business perspective. We've talked about this on a handful of shows, of the amount of people, both from a small scale or even a large scale, that jump into this industry assuming we can just make wine and people will buy it. They don't understand the hustle that has to happen to get people to drink your wine. Whether that's hosting tastings at the winery, being on the road and doing events, all of the above, you know, whatever the case may be, there's a lot of effort and it is a long game, right? If you're profitable in like 5 to 7 years in the wine industry, you're killing it. You're doing just fine. You get past that point and you get towards like 10 or so, you're like, okay, at least we got there. But it's a long haul. You're not just going to jump in necessarily and make a big splash. Obviously, exceptions apply, i.e. like the Prisoner Wine Company and Meiomi and like other things. Like shit on them for what they might be if you want to right now with how big and sweet some of those wines have gotten. But those are the, you know, big brands that have exploded, right? And really showed like, oh, hey, we can make tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars like that. Meanwhile, people didn't really know that it took years of, you know, expertise and maybe practice and time to get that to actually happen, right? Like those big splashes don't just happen overnight. There's still a lot of other stuff that has to go on to make that happen, right? And some of it's preparation plus preparedness, right? You're just ready for an opportunity when you get there. And every once in a while, you have a category just catch on and you just happen to be in the right place to catch that wave at the right time. You know, you can create your own luck in that sense. But now as we go down the road, you know, as we continue some of these conversations of, you know, maybe some of the issues that the Napa or California wine industry is facing, or, you know, where, how are we going to continue to adapt? I'm trying to think of the right way to say this. I think at a certain point, we need to take a lead from what worked in the past. Because I feel as though there have been so many people kind of chasing the dragon of what, like, the expectation of Napa was, maybe. And I kind of go back to the era of, like, I think the late 90s, early 2000s of Robert Parker's, like, Unfined, Unfiltered, and this, you know, style of wine that was very opulent and rich and sexy. And back in the day, if you got that 100-point score, you killed it. Like, you sold out a wine immediately, and you were the next big thing, right? Or the next culty thing, whatever the case was, right? And I think there were a lot of brands that just blindly jumped into that, and you saw, and that's kind of where I think, you know, a lot of this homogenization really came from. And it's not necessarily just Parker's fault, you know, but it's a lot of writers and reviewers and people that talk about vintages that say, oh, the good vintages are these hot, you know, arguably like drought conditions that make these really opulent wines. And I'm like, I don't think that's the case, because within the industry, within like our subset of wine drinkers, all of us love the cool vintages. There's more structure, there's more finesse, there's, you know, these great wines that maybe need a little bit more time from an aging perspective, but man, when you compare them to some of the hotter, warmer vintages around them, we, personally love them. Psalms, personally, like us wine geeks, like we love them. Go back to a 2011. Go back to, I think, an 06 or like, was 06 the really wet, rainy year? I think so. Maybe? Oh, I might be forgetting. 98 for sure, though. 98 and 11 for sure. Even 2010 was cool. And we're looking at the 2023s as well as being a very cool, long, extended harvest where grapes didn't necessarily get as ripe as they typically would. Kind of going back to these older vines and kind of farming tactics that were like, hey, we have to kind of deal with these vines that are a little diseased, a little torn up. Things aren't getting as ripe. So we have to find ways to, you know, produce these wines in a way that are, that has this finesse and this restraint. And they're just, yeah, maybe they're a little more structured and they're a little edgier in their youth, but you give them that time or that aging process or the right oak program rather than just all new oak all the time. And they get to where you want them to go. As opposed to harvest late, throw a bunch of new oak at it, let it rip. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but that certainly seems where, like, Napa specifically has gone. I think anyone would be kind of hard-pressed to disagree with me on that. And again, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, but I think it kind of got pushed so far that direction that a lot of people kind of lost sight of what was making Napa really special for a long time. And it wasn't these big alcoholic juice bombs with a bunch of new oak thrown at them. That's not what made Napa exciting. It was that these wines are big, they are rich, they're delicious, but they have this finesse and this approachability that at the time you weren't necessarily getting from a place like Bordeaux or Burgundy or whatever. You know, you didn't need to age Napa wines 20 years for them to be good and soften up and be what you wanted them to be. We could produce wines at a very high quality with a lot of finesse that were more ready to drink than some of our, you know, competitive set in terms of like wine regions around the world. That was something that was very special. But we knew that going big and going home with it at that time wasn't necessarily the play. We still wanted to have some of that structure. We still wanted to have that ageability to a certain point, even though less than 1% of people and wine drinkers in the U.S. age wines more than like 45 minutes. Like, it's a very small cohort of us wine drinkers that actually age wines more than just going to the store and buying a bottle and bringing it home, right? So with that, actually that's a good point too, is that because consumerism just is the way it is in this country with people kind of demanding sweeter things from a palate, you know, and style perspective, you also have folks that are more, you know, in the U.S. that are more instant gratification, just kind of the culture that we are. We needed just big, sexy, delicious wines that were, boom, pop the cork and go. You didn't necessarily need that finesse. It just needed to be sexy and delicious. And as a result, it's not that I think winemakers like overtly were like, we got to get away from this restraint thing. It just, we, to a certain extent, the industry just kind of chased what was popular and said, hey, people are drinking these big, sexy, higher alcohol wines. Let's just do that. You know? I mean, even for us, you know, even in our own production, there are certain wines, and this is going to surprise some of you, because some of you would assume, like, if for those of you, and there are a lot of you out there that listen to this, that know our wine program, that things like our Single Barrel Merlot, our Cab Franc, kind of these bigger, richer style of wines, you know, there's still, I think, a lot of great restraint in them. Obviously, those are like the biggest and boldest that we have to offer. But I try and balance that with, you know, what we've been talking about here today. But those aren't necessarily the wines that are like my favorites in our lineup. Now, it might be what I consider kind of the best barrel of Merlot, let's say, for that style of wine. But the wine that I love, and people, we get asked this all the time, like, what's your favorite wine in your lineup? And it's our Napa Valley Merlot. It always has been. That's what we started with. I obviously have a lot of heartstrings attached to it because that's the original wine of MTGA and how I got into winemaking in the first place. Everything else kind of came second to that because that's the flagship. That's the tentpole that really got us going. Now, does that mean I don't like making some of those bigger, richer styles? No, I love making them for what they are, but I'm very aware of what our house style is based on this wine that is the tentpole, and that's the Napa Valley Merlot. And that even if we kind of push certain barrels that are maybe a little riper, a little bit richer in style, with more new oak involved in them, that I still want those big wines to have finesse, that I still want them to have some restraint. And yes, maybe they're a little juicier. Maybe they're a little bit more intense and there's more new oak on them and they're this great toasty characteristic. But at their core, they're not a huge departure from what we started with and who we've been for 15 years. And I don't, this is going to sound bad, but I think that there are enough producers out there right now that didn't do that. They didn't kind of stick to their first principles. They kind of chased that dragon that we were talking about. And they lost some of just kind of the, I don't want to say like the intrinsic value of what their wines like used to be, because I think that's the wrong turn of phrase, but I think they did lose some of that restraint. They lost some of what made their wines really special and unique and interesting. And in chasing that dragon of a review or, you know, volume of sales with this bigger, richer style that's evolved over the last 20 plus years, they're now finding themselves in a position where it's like, hey, everybody's doing this. And the opinion from consumers about this style of wine right now isn't the best. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, like no shade to Springfield, Missouri. But when people in Springfield, Missouri are telling me that Napa wines are too rich and jammy and kind of slutty for them, that's a big shot across the bow. I love Springfield. It's a great town. I wouldn't necessarily say it's like a wine culture kind of town, but there is a great wine culture there. And when I hear that from kind of, you know, we talk about like kind of the major quote unquote markets of like the cab lovers in Dallas or, you know, Chicago or places in Florida and stuff that are kind of like, you know, these are the big places where people want to be placed and have their wines be in terms of wine sales. You know, we don't play in those markets nearly as much because as a small producer, it's very inefficient for us. But in the smaller cities with great food scenes, with great wine culture, despite the size of the population or how much business is actually done there, and people would be surprised how much business is actually done in Springfield. Those of you who know, know. But when you hear that kind of stuff coming from what are very discerning people, and consumers that have been into wine for a long time in a city that doesn't necessarily get the airtime that maybe it should, that's something to pay attention to. Because if a city like that, and I'm going to echo what I said in that episode previously, was if a city like that, or a state like Indiana, or Ohio, where, you know, there's great wine drinkers, great food scenes, depending on kind of where you're at in what city you're near or what town you're near. You know, when they're saying these wines are for the price, just not it. There's not enough finesse. There's not enough kind of like X factor to these wines anymore. And the expectation is if I see Napa on a label that it's going to be this high alcohol, jammy, oaky thing, I mean, that's a huge problem. Right? So going back to kind of how we started this episode, I think something's got to give when it comes to Napa. You know, number one, you know, tourism is down here. Why is that? Any number of reasons. Wine sales are down around the country. Whole bunch of reasons for that. How is the industry going to adjust? Clearly, there's pushback. There's oversupply and under demand for wine in general. And what we're hearing, kind of if we're putting our ear to the street, is that even the demand that is there is not necessarily keen on where these wines have gone generally from a stylistic standpoint, right? And the question then becomes, what gives? What's going to give? How is the industry going to adjust? What can we do to better serve you guys, the wine consumers of this country, and produce products that you actually want and can enjoy and are happy with? Whether it's that $5 bottle from Grocery Outlet or it's the $500 Colt wine. Right? That's what we have to get back to. And I think in the last, I mean, probably since about 2011, I mean, after the recession, kind of where wine has gone, coming from Napa specifically, not just the price, but the style, it's not advantageous to us anymore. And there are some of us, I like to think, between Brittany and I, that have seen that writing kind of on the wall as it was getting started and saying, you know what, if this is the direction that everyone else is going in, we need to find something else to make this work for us and stand out of the sea of people that are chasing this style. Because that's going to be a flooded market at some point. Certainly wasn't today, that day, back in 2012 or 13 when we were releasing our first wines. But it's here now. 10 years later, it's here now. And I hope, I hate to see a lot of these brands have trouble. We have friends that work for them. They're colleagues of ours. It's tough to see, people get laid off and places close up shop. Like it sucks. But this is looking through some rose-colored glasses, but the writing was on the wall. Whether or not you decided to pay attention was kind of up to you. And I'm not saying I like shook my crystal ball 10 years ago and, said, "Oh, this is what's coming. Better watch out," because I certainly didn't, but I knew from a stylistic standpoint what I didn't think was going to be successful in the long term. And maybe that's playing out now. Maybe we're seeing that prophecy come to fruition. I'll shake my magic eight ball again and we'll see where we go from here. But something does have to give. And the brands that are successful right now in Napa that are weathering this storm well, hopefully other colleagues and labels and people start to pay attention and start to come back to kind of maybe, what their first principles were when they got into this industry, whether that was 10 years ago, whether that was 50 years ago. Let's get back to basics of making wines that are of exceptional quality and of great value, and not just marking something up for the sake of marking something up. Something has got to give. All right, I think that'll do it for today. I appreciate you all being patient with me as we've been kind of back and forth, and when we've been releasing episodes the last few weeks between being on the road, getting back into gear, it has, I'm not going to lie, it's been really nice to kind of kick back and relax, get some housework done, help friends out with home projects, get a little up, stepped a foot onto a golf course for the first time in like 15 or 20 years, a couple of days ago, played some bocce ball, doing trivia nights. Like, I'm not going to lie, we've tried to take a little bit of R&R over the last week and a half in particular. Especially with the Bottle Rock Music Festival here this week, it's kind of our kickoff of like, all right, we can finally relax a little bit before things pick back up as we get into June and into July. So I appreciate all of you tuning in. Please continue to share, like, subscribe to the show wherever you're consuming it. Share it with friends, family, any other winos that are in your life. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's YouTube, where you can find a whole bunch of videos and tasting notes. You can watch me dance around here in my home office if you want to watch the episodes and kind of consume the podcast. Instagram is also where we're really active. You can also follow us on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Thank you all. Have an amazing rest of your Memorial Day weekend, and we will see you next time here on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.